I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are going to be talking a bit about Corona-chan, coronavirus, or as I like to call it, global virus. But before we get into that, we want to talk about some changes of plans that have been caused by this pandemic. So, Frody, why don't you go first?
Many people have contacted me and asked about the Scanza Forum that is scheduled to take place on the 2nd of May in Zagreb, Croatia, with a debate between Jared Taylor and E. Michael Jones. You know, I tried to wait as long as possible because I didn't want to make any premature decision. But I think that I can't really wait any longer because I think the trajectory of this pandemic is quite clear. Many countries have closed down their borders. Some have closed them for a month. Some have closed them for weeks. Some have closed them without setting a time limit. So I think that the only responsible thing to do is to postpone the conference. And that's what I'm going to do. I've just now written a article that might come up on Countercurrents, or an announcement that might come up on Countercurrents when this is published, this audio is published. Basically, the thing is that, sure, the borders to Croatia might be open by the end of April or beginning of May. We don't know that, but we can't really wait and see, because even if those borders are open, maybe other countries have travel restrictions that make it impossible for both speakers and for guests to come to Croatia. And also, we have some speakers who are in the sort of broad age group that has a heightened risk, and some of our guests as well, and we want to encourage them to not travel. So basically, I've decided to postpone this. I've not canceled the conference, but I've decided to reschedule it. And when the smoke clears away and we know more about where this is going and what we can expect, we can set a new date for this. So that's the important part.
When do you think you are going to postpone it to?
I don't really know. I mean, I don't want to say anything before we know more, because right now we have travel restrictions. Yeah, you know, mid-April in some countries. Some countries haven't set a time limit, and we don't know the trajectory of the pandemic itself. It looks like it's going down in Asia. It's going down to better levels, and it's still expanding, as far as we can tell, in Europe. So I don't really know. I mean, yeah, Likely after the summer, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't find it likely that you know this will happen during the summer, because as it looks right now, we have there's no prospect of it going away anytime soon, really.
Yeah, and then even if it does go away, there's still going to be a lot of economic consequences, things that people need to sort out. It's just going to be very difficult for people to commit to coming to this.
Exactly.
It's not going to be any sooner than the fall.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, because even if the borders are, if they were open in May, we can't really, you know, make any travel plans now. And it's now we have to make the travel plans,
right?
You know, you have to schedule it a few months ahead so that people can make travel plans and so on, because people travel far to go to these conferences. So you can't just give them like 2 weeks notice. So whenever we're going to set a date, we're going to set it so that people can, you know, reasonably make their travel plans and all, you know, all of that. So that's, we take those things into consideration, because right now, I mean, we can't continue selling tickets and asking people to book flights and so on when it's very uncertain that this will happen in May. So that's why I just made a final decision that, you know, we can't go ahead as it looks now. We have to wait until this is blown over, and then we're going to go ahead, because I definitely don't want to cancel the event, because we have gotten so much enthusiastic response to this debate and the overall event that it would be a crime to cancel it. So we have to go through with it.
Yeah. It's not a question of whether it's going to happen, but just when.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's reasonable. A pandemic is the prime example of force majeure. It's an outside force that you can't control and you can't plan for. I mean, even travel companies, airlines and so on, they have offered special treatment of this case when, you know, travel restrictions prevent you from going places. You can reschedule your flight. So if anyone has booked their flight, I think they should contact their airline as soon as possible to see if they can rebook their flights or get a refund for canceling or something like that, because many airlines have special treatment for this very special circumstance. So hopefully we can sort of limit the damage of this happening. And so another thing, connected with that is that we have already made a lot of payments that we have no prospect of getting back. So this turn of events has already hurt us financially. So if someone listening to this, if you guys like what we do, if you like our work and you want to support us through this challenge, please consider sending us a donation. And also, we have been cut off from our credit card processor, so we can't receive money that way, contributions that way. So basically, we are left with cryptocurrency, and you can send us cash, and you can send us a few other ways. But if cryptocurrency, we have put out on the website the address for Bitcoin and Ethereum. If you want to send us contributions some other way, you can just send me an email to info@scanzaforum.com. And also, of course, if someone is listening to this and has questions about the upcoming event, just send me an email and I'll try to respond as soon as possible, because obviously these unforeseen circumstances have put a lot more stuff on our on our table that we have to deal with. So it might take a little while, longer than expected, to get back to you. But just send me an email and we'll take care of everything.
Great. One thing that has happened is the cancellation of the American Renaissance Conference. That is at the end of May. And Jared Taylor decided that it would be necessary to cancel it anyway. And given that the Scanza Forum is at the very beginning of May, it seems very likely that if AMREN isn't going to happen, then Scanza really can't be counted on happening either, and they just need to be, it needs to be postponed. Yeah. I was planning on doing an event in New York City 2 weeks after American Renaissance. It was going to be on the Saturday, the 13th of June. Countercurrents' 10th anniversary is the 11th of June. And so on Saturday the 13th, because it's the earliest weekend or closest weekend, we were going to do a party and a fundraiser and sort of a little conference in celebration of Countercurrents existing for 10 years, 10 years of success and growth. We are going to have to basically cancel that as well. We can't postpone a birthday for 6 months. We might as well just cancel it and try doing it next year, right? We'll do something else that won't actually involve getting together in a city that has a plague raging in it and probably still will by the middle of June. So that has been canceled as well. And I will let you know what plans we're going to make, but none of the plans that we're going to make for this and upcoming anniversary are going to be an event where people can travel and visit and hang out with one another. It's just not feasible. So that has also been canceled.
Some people, they have been looking at, for example, in the case of the Scanza Forum, they've been looking at Croatia specifically. But you have to take into consideration that it's not only Croatia. Croatia has quite low numbers of infections compared to many other countries. But the thing is that many of our guests travel to Croatia. So their countries also have to be taken into consideration. So this is an international nationalist movement. So we have to look at the big picture and take that whole thing into consideration when we make these decisions.
Right. Right now, the death toll in Italy has surpassed the reported death toll in China. So Europe is now the center of this pandemic. And there are a lot of countries in Europe that have skyrocketing numbers, most of them Western European countries, most of them prosperous, cosmopolitan Western European countries, whereas the Central and Eastern European countries don't have quite the same number of cases yet. And a little country like Croatia, if they have a low number of cases, but they're right across the Adriatic from Italy, they're going to be very, very careful. And especially very careful about admitting people from countries with high rates of infection. And I'm afraid that's practically every country in Europe. It's going to be Canada, it's going to be the United States. And the reason for this is very simple. This is a virus that has been made possible by globalization. And the more globalized the economy, the more affluent, the more cosmopolitan the society, the more people traveling in and out of that society, the more Chinese in that society as students and, you know, immigrants and things like that, the more chance that there's going to be a huge outbreak. And so this is going to be a huge problem in Western Europe, in Scandinavia, and in the United States and Canada.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Croatia has a total of 105 cases right now. They have one death, but they have, just for comparison, in relation to the size of the country and the size of the total population, they have 26 cases per 1 million in the population. 26 cases. China has 56 cases per 1 million. Italy has 679 cases. So it's like 12 times more than China in relation to the size of the population. That's how severe this is in Italy right now. So yeah, it's bad. It's definitely a European thing. I mean, Spain also has huge numbers. The same with Switzerland, Denmark, Norway. Those countries are in the top, and they are not gonna. They're not going to deal with this problem. You know, they're not going to be done with it within a few weeks. This is going to be a thing that takes time. So we just have to, you know, wait and see before we make any new decisions.
Right, exactly. So you are in the Faroe Islands. Tell us about the outbreak in the Faroe Islands. I would think that being in the Faroe Islands would be, well, kind of remote and hard to get to. And probably a good place to wait out a pandemic. So what's the situation there?
The Faroe Islands is sort of a part of Scandinavia, although it's located in the middle of the Atlantic. So it's you know, Scandinavian population. So it has the same kind of mentality, I guess, although not really as stupid as Sweden is currently. But it's the same sort of naivety. It's like people react only when it's too late. I remember when this first started exploding over in China, there was a Swedish guy, I guess like a businessman or something, who was in the Wuhan, in that area where it started, and he was traveling back to Sweden. So he wrote to the health authorities in Sweden and asked if they wanted him to do some tests or something before he came into the country. And they said, no, just come back. And we don't need to run any tests on you. And the same thing with, you know, it's just continue. They just continue letting planes in to the country. So, I mean, this thing could have been prevented from coming to Europe. So people are responsible for this happening. This isn't just some weird fluke. We have known about this risk for months. We have known about what's going on, but the people in charge have just chosen to do nothing, and now we're suffering the consequences, as usually with these people. So that's where it all starts. I think that the people who started this thing or who were the first to be infected on the Faroe Islands, it started out with two people last week, and then it went on to 9 people, and then 18, and then overnight it went from 18 to 48, and then the next day from 48 to 58, and now it's up at 72. Yesterday it was 58, now it's 72. So 14. I mean, in terms of percent, that's a huge growth.
How many people are in the Faroe Islands?
So the Faroe Islands has a total of 50,000 people. So yeah, that is in relation to the population, the total population. Those are huge numbers. Like I said, China has 56 cases per 1 million.
Oh wow, well that is a really alarming rate.
It's probably the largest in the world, Ren.
Hungary has 10 million people, and the number of cases in Hungary is about 78, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, a very small, isolated, you know, tight population like that, 72 cases is a lot. So I came here because, like everyone probably who knows me knows that I'm from the Faroe Islands. I went here last week for a family thing, sort of because I had to, and then all of a sudden they closed the borders, so I can't get back to mainland Scandinavia again for the foreseeable future. I mean, there are some flights and so on, but it's mostly restricted now to just like emergency travel. Mm-hmm. Casual travel isn't allowed. So Denmark has closed its borders. The Faroe Islands has closed its borders. Many countries around Europe have closed their borders, and some have set a time limit. Some have not yet. You know, they have just wait and see sort of. I think I don't know about Sweden and the UK. The last time I read about them was a couple of days ago, and they still have open borders because they want to achieve herd immunity. they want to just do a huge epidemiological experiment on their population and see what happens. Instead of playing it safe, these people are clinically, they are insane. These are psychopaths running our societies. And what is worse, I mean, there's just so much to say about this, but Finland and other countries have, they have a policy of closing their borders for, you know, you and me, like normal people traveling, but they still have open borders for asylum seekers.
Oh, God.
This is no joke.
Well, gee, no, you know, eventually they're going to be having to close the borders to protect those asylum seekers from the charnel houses that Sweden and Finland have become. That's the absurdity. The only reason they'll ever close the borders to these people is if things get so bad that they're doing it for their protection. For the protection of the outsiders.
Exactly. I mean, that's a thing you always hear by these sort of milquetoast, very liberal nationalist parties, like the Sweden Democrats, for example. They always say that, we can do more to help them if we help them in the vicinity of the country they're coming from. So, I mean, if people flee from Syria, if we support them financially in some nearby country, we can help more of them. But it never enters into the argument that what is good for us is just how can we help more of them? And they try to make some sort of circular reasoning around that instead of going to the core of the issue. What's good for us? That never entered into the debate at all from their perspective. Yeah.
It's just a moral failing, basically, or it's a form of moral fanaticism. It's basically a fanatical moral objection to white people acting in their own collective self-interest. That is the worst possible thing in the world, according to the people who run our countries today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the thing is here, it's been insane. I was on the Faroe Islands, obviously, as the word would suggest, it's made up of islands, so you have to take ferries between them, and usually the boats are quite big, because that's the foundation of traveling here. And now they have travel restrictions, so that on a huge ferry, they only take 50 passengers, 50 walk-on passengers, and then 50 people who, you know, enter the boat by car. So a total of 100 passengers on like these big boats. So these are weird times, and everyone is just isolated in their houses because these are, you know, drastic measures. And when you go to some like nightclubs are closed, bars are closed, restaurants are closed, all kinds of shops are closed. It's just grocery shops have limited opening hours, so you can still, you know, go for grocery shopping and so on. But everything else is closed, and everyone is just staying in. You don't see a person anywhere. And you go into the grocery shop. I was there yesterday, and you put on these one-time, you know, these gloves. I don't know what you would call them, like the things that you just use once and then throw away for shopping, so you don't touch anything. And they have put up, you know, like stickers on the floor to encourage people to keep at least 2 meters distance, so they don't get close to each other. This is a surreal thing. I took pictures of those signs, you know, put on these gloves before you go shopping, and because that will just be such a weird thing to look back on a few years down the road when you look back at these events, just to live through this weird time. It's like a movie. It's like, you know, Stephen King's The Stand or something. Right. But you're actually experiencing this weird, very unusual thing. And I think I've said this, you know, I've said this several times, that I think this will turn out to be the most dramatic thing that happens in the West since the Second World War, because this is not only the virus, you know, people dying from the virus. It's the secondary consequences that are the really dramatic ones, because just imagine if you are a small business owner and you run a business, you don't have, you know, huge margins, a lot of you know, money to spend. You have to pay all the bills and so on, and then business just stops because everyone stays at home for a week. I talked to a car mechanic, and you know, he runs a small business. He's a car mechanic, and you know, he has a lot to do and he's busy, and then all of a sudden it stops. And, you know, he has to pay the bills. He just bought some new equipment for the shop, and, you know, some new piece of machinery. And that's expensive. He has to pay it, but no money comes in. And that's like for a week. That's tough. That's tough on small business owners for a week. This will maybe last for months. You know, when all activity stops for months and everyone is just sitting at home, that's going to have huge consequences down the road, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, immense economic consequences, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's not just that. It's like all these things taken together. Now we have an invasion from Turkey, and we have people just going crazy in shops. I mean, I saw a video from France, people fighting in grocery shops, you know, over the last scraps of toilet paper or something. People just going at it. And a friend of mine, he told me that they've actually deployed the army to keep order in Paris. This is something huge that's actually happening.
That's fascinating. Yeah, because the French are really very patient, in my experience, about queuing. And now there are fights and riots. Well, for one thing, there are a lot of people in France who are only French in a very legal sense of the word. They're not actually ethnically French. So I imagine that all the rifts in multicultural societies, the lack of trust, the depleted social capital, all of these chickens are coming home to roost now. You can skate along depleting your social capital for a long, long, long time, as long as everything else is normal. But when there's a crisis, when there's a test, then you find out how brittle and hollowed out your society is. And these Western European countries and America and Canada are all going to have a stress test. And we're going to see that diversity is not a source of strength. That's one huge lesson here to be learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And I've said that, you know, the migration crisis of 2015, which recruited enormous number of people to right-wing politics and the right-wing way of seeing things and nationalism and closing borders and, you know, controlling the borders, that's going to be seen as a footnote compared to the 2020, like the pandemic combined with the invasion from Turkey, combined with whatever riots and looting we're going to see when everyone is staying at home, all the bad people will start looting, and with all the financial consequences. Usually people don't have a lot of room to play with in their economy. So if they don't get paid for a couple of months, I mean, some countries have put in, you know, support systems and so on, but it's not going to be enough for a couple of months. That's not what I believe. I don't believe it's going to be enough for a couple of months to sustain all of this. So because, you know, the money is coming from somewhere, right? And we don't just have these huge, this huge surplus of money that we can just give away. So then when this stops and people can't really pay their rent anymore, pay their the mortgages on their houses, they're not going to think that it's very fun to give away to invaders. So I think this is going to have enormous consequences, this the thing that we're experiencing right now. And frankly, it's kind of exciting. You know, I don't want to gloat.
No, I don't want to gloat. The way I put it in my latest article on it is that coronavirus is going to change the world, and I just hope that I live to see it.
Yeah.
It's going to produce huge changes. And let's just talk about some of the changes.
Sure.
Let's just run through some of the major concepts here that are going to be stress tested and are going to be discarded.
Yeah.
First of all, globalism, erasing borders, making it easy for people in mass numbers to move all around the world. There are two elements of globalism, really. One is movement of people. The other is movement of goods.
Right.
And let's just talk about the easy movement of peoples. The Schengen zone, that has effectively been abolished now, right? The United States has had a porous border with Mexico for decades. We put a man on the moon, but we just somehow can't get it together and close our southern border. That's what we're told, right? We just can't close our southern border. Now Mexico wants to close its northern border with the United States because they're afraid of the coronavirus pandemic coming in. And suddenly that's totally feasible. It's feasible for the Mexicans to close their American border, but it's not been feasible for Americans to do the same thing for a generation or more.
Right.
I mean, the absurdity of that is so delicious. It's just wonderful. But yeah, the open borders, mass movement of peoples, all of that is coming to a halt. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, because of the insane priorities of the governing system, as you pointed out, they're still taking in refugees and things like that. But that will come to a halt. Eventually, I think sympathy for that is going to come to a halt when within Finland, there are going to be Finns who are basically refugees. There are going to be Finns who need soup kitchens. Because there are going to be a lot of people who are impoverished. Because what's going to come from this is a Great Depression, a great economic depression. Because the global economy is so interconnected, and it's so fragile to disruption. And it's being disrupted not only in terms of just moving goods around, but also just people can't work. People can't work, they can't leave their houses, they can't do all these things. And when they finally start trying to get the economy going again, they're going to find that they don't have the people, that the parts don't fit together. All kinds of things are going to be missing.
Yeah.
And it's just going to be very, very difficult to just snap your fingers and go back to normal. There's going to be a long, long period of economic chaos that's going to lead to poverty and suffering and political instability. So this isn't going to be over when the virus dies down. It's going to go on for a long time. And basically, all the generosity, the pathological altruism, the open borders, you know, Europe as a global soup kitchen, America as a global soup kitchen, all of that's going to come to a screaming halt. Oh, this cracked me up. Michael Bloomberg says he's going to donate $40 million to help coronavirus. And it's going to be earmarked for Africa. You know, 6 months ago, if he said he was donating $40 million to some health crisis in Africa, you know, you and I would roll our eyes, but we wouldn't be laughing, right? It just doesn't pass the laugh test to do that kind of nonsense anymore. Is Bill Gates going to talk about spending billions of dollars on Africa when the American economy is going to be in chaos? I just don't think so. I think that the economic consequences of this are going to end white global altruism. There's just not going to be the surplus for that anymore. And I don't think that the people who call for that are going to be very, how to put it, they're not going to be encouraged to do so as
right.
much as they are now. They're not going to be given credit. Oh, how idealistic. They're just going to be looked on as kooks, as laughable
yeah.
kooks, or worse. So I think that's coming to a screeching halt.
It is. It is. And the thing is that, you know, all these things are just built on false assumptions. And they only work. I mean, globalism, liberalism, all these things, they are false ideologies. They are built on false assumptions about how society works and about how humans work. And they can only work as long as you can bribe people and as long as there is abundance. Now, as soon as people are test, and we have to keep in mind that abundance, financial abundance and peace and prosperity, that is a historical anomaly. That's not the typical state in human nature throughout human history. It's only in the post-World War era, many people throughout the West have, you know, had abundance in terms of, you know, they've always had food, they've always had everything they need, and they've had healthcare, most of them. I mean, some people have, of course, been suffering and been poor, but not in comparison to how it was like 200 years ago when you basically had to fight for your survival every single day. And now when we basically go back to what's normal, these things are tested because now people can't be bribed into accepting liberalism because there's no more money to bribe them with. People are going to be poor. People are not going to be able to pay all their bills and so on. And when that happens, when you get out of this sort of Schlaraffenland, then you are forced to face reality and you're forced to make some sort of priorities. And then conflicts arise because one of my favorite articles that you wrote was like a review of Carl Schmitt, The Concept of the Political. And there was a phrase in that, probably 10 years ago since you wrote it, I guess. But there's a phrase in that where you said that, where you sort of paraphrase him, saying that liberalism is sort of pretending that conflicts don't exist anymore. And the thing is that when push comes to shove and when people can't put food on their tables and they can't pay their bills anymore, then this sort of liberal high and mighty bullshit goes out the window because then they have to actually make priorities. And I think a lot of those people will come to the conclusion that we are not best served by throwing away money on people invading our countries and raping our women and looting our stores and attacking our young people and urinating on our young people through these humiliation crime and dominance crime and so on. I don't think people will be very motivated to give away money to those people anymore. And I think that is, you know, that is then they're going to see what's really important. And that's going to be the interesting part. And I think that's going to, a lot of that is going to change during 2020 and the following years, because the consequences of this are not going to stop, you know, in a couple of months. We're going to see huge consequences of this.
Yeah, I am really tightening my belt economically. We've been cut off from the global credit card industry. I've seen my cryptocurrency wallet fall in value by 50%.
Yeah.
And I have a P.O. box in San Francisco, and the person who empties that P.O. box, which is in a heavily Chinese neighborhood, is a woman in her over 65 who is in one of the high-risk categories and really can't safely go out and check my box. So I wrote to her today, and I said, let's just revisit this in a month. We can talk about it later. So even the money that is coming into the P.O. box and orders coming into the P.O. box, we're not going to have access to for a while. And I apologize to everybody out there who sent in a donation or sent in a book order for that matter. We, you know, times are really tough. I mean, this is a bad situation. Little things like that are breaking down our abilities to, you know, do business, fill orders. You don't want to ask a person who is happy as a favor to empty my P.O. box under normal circumstances to basically risk her life to do the same thing. Yeah, you just can't do that anymore. So everything is changing.
everything has changed. And you know, we're going to learn the value that our grandparents understood, the value of having a buffer, you know, not just throwing away everything, because everything isn't video games. When things come down to life or death, it's not video games that are important anymore. Then you really have to focus on the essential stuff. And I think that's healthy. That's a reality check for us now.
It really is healthy. One thing that I urge everybody to do is to take this as an opportunity to appreciate what you already have more. Instead of, you know, thinking, I should go out and get this new something or other that's come out, you know, I'll just pop on the streetcar and go to the store and buy it. It's like, well, wait. Suddenly the transaction costs are higher. The risks are higher. And there's a book sitting on my shelf that I haven't read yet. Or
many of those.
Yeah, we have many of those. Or there's a book that I love and I would like to reread. Maybe this is the time to do things like that, to take an inventory of all the stuff you already have and learn to appreciate it more. Well, let's talk about some of the other things that are changing. For instance, democracy. Democracy has some benefits to it, but clearly one of the great demerits of democracy is that political leaders basically are thinking only ahead to re-election. They're thinking only in terms of their term of office and maybe, you know, one or two terms down the road. Political leaders like American presidents, they have 4 years, and then if they're lucky, they have four more years. And if you're thinking in that way, basically you have all this incentive to think short term. And if plans need to be made, if institutions need to be built, if provisions need to be made against preventable evils like epidemics, chances are it's just not going to happen. A president who wanted to say, when Trump got elected or when Trump was running, I was thinking, you know, one great thing that America should do is we need another Marshall Plan, another Manhattan Project, another space program. We need big projects that mobilize lots of energies and spark economic development and technological development. And I thought, well, how about making a defense network for the planet against, say, asteroids and comets that come crashing down every few million years? But when it happened to the dinosaurs, that was the end of the dinosaurs, right? Yeah. I think it was in the 1980s, there was an event where the Shoemaker-Levy comet struck the surface of Jupiter. Now, that's a couple... Well, not the surface, but it struck Jupiter. It's a big gas ball, right? Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was a couple planets out, right? If it had struck the surface of the Earth, we'd all be extinct. It would have been a global extinction event, right? There'd be cockroaches doing podcasts today and not people. And the point is, though, that kind of event has already happened on our planet, in our planet's history, and it could happen again, and we would have technological solutions to prevent that if we did the R&D necessary for it. But to do that, you can't have democratically elected politicians who are only thinking short term, right? Even if they wanted to do stuff like that, they would have so much of their political capital and time consumed by little crises caused by the poor planning of previous people, right? So there's something inherently bad about democracy in that it shortens the time horizons of planners and leaders and lets us become vulnerable to these sorts of pandemics and disasters that could be planned for. We suffer all kinds of unnecessary evils because the democratic system is what it is, and that means that it's a system that's focused on the short term rather than on the long term.
Yeah, wasn't it Aristotle who said that, well, it was Aristotle who said that landowners, the people who have, land, they live off their land, they're not employed, they live off their land, and their land will be inherited from generation to generation, they should have the major political influence because they plan far ahead. So they would have the most incentive to have sustainable policies. And that just goes out the window in democracy.
Yeah, an urbanized democracy with a business elite rather than a landed gentry becomes a very different kind of society. There's this lovely saying about a civilized society, or one mark of a civilized society is that people plant trees so that their grandchildren can enjoy the shade.
Right.
We just don't have that sense of responsibility and farsightedness in democratic societies anymore. We're just not bred for that. We don't have leadership bred for that. And this is one of the things that we're going to suffer because of
that. Yeah. Yeah, that's not really what motivates the sort of Sex and the City career feminist. Because those are the people who are very influential in this society, the people who just live according to the norms in popular TV channels and TV shows and all that bullshit. Those are not people who want to be responsible and who make responsible decisions that are going to benefit future generations, because many of them don't really want kids. They are like urbanite feminists and careerists and individualists, and that's why they have created this horrible society that is not fit for humans anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's obvious why global free trade is a bad thing when now the United States imports 90% of its pharmaceuticals from China. there are lots of problems with that. One, if China has a pandemic, they're going to use it for themselves and they're not going to export it, which is what we've seen happen. And two, basically it makes us susceptible to blackmail by the Chinese.
Right.
It's an absurd situation, and people have been saying this for years. Protectionists, nationalists have been saying this for decades. You cannot allow basically short-sighted, profit-motivated businessmen to dismantle strategically necessary industries within our country and ship them abroad to global rivals. But that's happened again because the leadership in America doesn't put America first, doesn't think about the long-term interests of the society anymore. And so they've created this catastrophic situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything they do. I mean, everything they do is well, none of their decisions, let's put it that way instead, none of their decisions are for the people they are supposed to represent and protect. They go for special interests, they go for their own career, because we have just lost track of what's really important, and that is, the long-term interests of our ethnic group. And it would just be completely obvious to anyone that if a pandemic hit 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago in China, you would stop people from entering your country from that country. But now globalism is so much taken for granted, and it's such a holy value that you're not even allowed to criticize it when it's, it threatens to kill huge numbers of your people.
Exactly. We have basically two interest groups that keep globalism open. One is the left, who want to use it basically as a way of ethnically swamping our societies with foreigners. And the other is the business right, who have all kinds of sweet business deals with the Far East. And they don't want anything to get in the way of that because they're so invested in the Chinese economy now. So that is a terrible situation, and it's really the situation with globalization everywhere in every Western country. The United States can't have a closed border with Mexico. Why? Because the left wants welfare cases and the right wants cheap labor.
It just forces us to reevaluate our values, because money knows no borders. And when things get really tough, like it will most likely be now, then you are forced to sort of question what is really valuable. And that really becomes, you know, the people you are around. Who do you want to be around? Do you want to be in central Paris when the crisis hits and the system, quote unquote, breaks down and there's no more police to protect you, and there's no when you basically enter a state of nature, when when the civilized sort of surface level things that we have gotten used to, when those things disappear, where do you want to be? Do you want to be, what kind of people do you want to be around? Because like I said, you know, this has been a historical anomaly that everyone has been comfortable for, you know, decades, and they've had everything they need, and they can take their safety for granted. They don't have to fight for it all the time. So is it money, or is it actually the people you're around? Because in a homogeneous society, a white ethno state, a place like Estonia, like I talked about in you know, our last show that we did together, that, you know, which is a normal country that all white countries used to be a few decades ago. In a place like that, if the economy collapses and the police isn't really able to do his job anymore, and you know, all the civilized things disappear, I wouldn't expect a lot of rioting and a lot of fighting over toilet paper and all of that. But in Paris, or in London for that matter, when all those safety mechanisms disappear, because there is no natural glue that keeps people together, because they're not similar to each other, and because they're not, yeah, well, they're not white, you can expect a lot of different consequences. So I think people are going to realize that pretty quickly.
Yeah, we just need to get back to the attitude that some things are sacred and sacred things can't be bought by money. Mm-hmm. And the preservation of your people, your family, your community, your race, your nation, etc., those are sacred things. And mm-hmm. the money people, they're servants of a very different God. Right. Mm-hmm. They have a different value system, and they're unclean. There's just something unclean about people who put money before everything else. And that really brings us to the conservatives in America.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why this crisis is going to get so bad in the United States, and it is going to get really bad. Mm-hmm. The United States did not take it seriously early enough that we stopped, you know, people coming in, mm-hmm. and initiated social distancing and started testing. And I believe every major metropolitan area of the United States is probably saturated now with this virus, and that within a few weeks we're going to have tens and then hundreds of thousands of cases, many of them requiring hospitalization. And we're rapidly going to max out our hospital facilities, and we're going to have people dying. We're going to have many people dying of an easily preventable disease. You know? And the purpose of government is to foresee and secure us against preventable evils, and they have not done that. Why haven't they done it? Well, the people in charge in Washington are Republicans, and mm-hmm. Republicans, unfortunately, are basically just shills of big business, including big global corporations that have dismantled America's economy and offshored it largely to China. These people had a huge interest in keeping the borders open, keeping trade open, keeping people going back and forth. The airline industry is a huge industry with a huge lobby. Their entire business is just shifting people all around the globe. Mm-hmm. And also, Republicans are very, very concerned about just money. A lot of them don't have any real core convictions except what we would call libertarianism. They might, you know, pay lip service to conservatism and things like that, but really they're just libertarians when you really get down to what they actually believe in. They don't believe that any government intervention in the economy is desirable or moral, and therefore they will do anything basically to protect the economy from sick people. They don't want to protect people from getting sick. They're more concerned with protecting the economy from sick people, protecting the economy from the inevitable downturn if we close unnecessary businesses, cancel events, stop all this air travel, etc. They're only worried about that, and they had the ear of the president. Early on, Trump came into office as a populist and a nationalist. And he was slowly, basically swallowed up by the Republican Party. And the worst sign of this has been his decision to premise his entire reelection campaign on the economy, on economic good news.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the good news is over. And the thing is that he knew that if the economy had a downturn, he wasn't going to get reelected, and a lot of rich people that he knows and that he's beholden to would be less wealthy. And so the incentive for the government was to lie and minimize and prevent people from harming the economy rather than to prevent this disease from harming the people.
Right. I've seen some reactions from conservatives that just come across as clinically insane. The people who claim that this is it's just a flu, man, this is just mass hysteria. You shouldn't encourage people to stay at home because this is just like a flu. Why do people care about that? It's like less than 1% that's gonna have to care about this. Well, it's not just like a flu. Right now, of the closed cases, there is 10% mortality. There are currently, I'm looking at the latest numbers while we record this, there are 96,494 cases which have been closed, which have an outcome, that is, that are either recovered or dead. Of those 96,000, there are 9,800 deaths. That is 10% of the closed cases are dead and 90% recovered. But that's not the important part, because yes, it is true that it is the older risk groups that have a higher risk of dying from the disease, but that's not the major problem. The major problem is that many people get ill and have to go to the hospital, and the hospitals are overburdened, which means that other people who need healthcare can't get it because it's just chaos everywhere. If you just look at the pictures from Italy, for example, people are like, they have hospital beds in parking lots, because the healthcare system isn't calibrated for handling an event like this. So you have to limit the event because the secondary consequences are enormous. And so these people just don't understand it.
It's not just the people who died of coronavirus. It's the people who died because they couldn't get proper hospitalization for other problems during the epidemic.
There have been so many examples of this that people just can't get access to a hospital because they're full. So they just have to stay at home.
Yeah, and so we need to add those deaths to the coronavirus death toll as well. There are the primary deaths, people who actually die of the virus, and there are secondary deaths who they don't die because of the virus, they die because of the consequences of the viral outbreak. Yeah. It would be interesting to find those numbers. It would be hard to calculate those numbers. People need to keep track of those numbers, though.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, you have to be a real sort of dumbass conspiracy theorist to think that a country like China will tank its economy for fun because it's just a flu, man. Or other countries for that matter, that they will close down businesses and tell people to stay at home, close all activity for months, which will crash the economy if it wasn't necessary. Why would they do? What is the conspiracy theory justification for that?
Right. The cringiest person in America is this Trump cultist named Bill Mitchell, who's been going off about this, minimizing the risks and talking about how important it is to save his 401k, right? And
What is that?
A 401k is a retirement plan that people have, which is basically stocks, right? They're just worried about the stock market, right? So this Mitchell guy has gone almost as far as to suggest that maybe the entire virus is made up, which is quite nutty, which means that, you know, the Chinese were in on this plan, right? This plan by the liberal media to ruin the Trump administration. That's what he's trying to push, the idea that this is a conspiracy by the left to create an economic crisis so that Trump doesn't get reelected. And you have to shake your head at somebody this stupid. Are all these European governments in on the conspiracy against Donald Trump? Right? They're all panicking their people and closing their borders and crashing their economies to get Donald Trump. It's so dumb. It's so dumb.
Putin changed sides, you know? Is Putin in on the conspiracy against Trump now? Or
right, yeah. Good point. Good point. Yeah, so this is just fascinating. But the basic thing that's going on here is these Republicans are trying to minimize the threat in order to lessen the damage to the economy, because that's all they really care about. Yeah. And they are willing to use the most sophistical arguments. For instance, they're pointing out that it wasn't so bad in China. Yeah, it wasn't so bad in China. What did China do? China had draconian totalitarian measures to confine people. We're not doing that in the United States.
They locked up 60 million people in their own houses. More than that, probably.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. the United States isn't going to do that. So doesn't that mean that countries that won't do that kind of stuff because they don't want to tank the economy are going to have it worse? Right? So, but they're doing everything they can to minimize the danger, to increase complacency. And Matthew Goodwin cited a poll that indicated that Republicans are far less alarmed by this than Democrats and think it's going to get better far sooner. And that attitude is going to have real costs. People who believe this are going to get sick more, and their families are going to get sick more. They're going to die. They're going to die because of the selfishness and the complacency of Republicans who are basically worshipers of mammon. They're all about the money. And unfortunately, those people really deflected the president's response early on. Now, it seems like he's finally heard wiser voices and it has gotten more serious about it. And we can thank Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, the commentator, seems to have talked a lot of sense into Trump. He met with him and talked to him, and his commentaries were also directed basically to Trump. Tucker Carlson is going to save a lot of American lives because he played a huge role in turning the American response around and actually getting the Trump administration to take this problem seriously against all the bad advice coming from the Chamber of Commerce people. That's some good news. Now, the other stuff that's kind of amazing is, you know, the bad economic news, of course, had all these mega corporations queuing up for federal bailouts. And there are going to be federal bailouts. There's no question about it. And banks and major corporations are going to get lots and lots of money. The thing that amazes me is they have actually embraced an emergency universal basic income idea. They're going to give 2 months at least. They're planning on checks in April and May. 2 months of basically stimulus money direct to American taxpayers. Which is a wonderful thing. This was what Andrew Yang was proposing. It's going to be at least $1,000 a month. It'll be more for some people. And this is a great thing. So, and the other thing that was really remarkable is it's been floated that, well, if the United States is going to bail out mega corporations, we want an ownership stake in those corporations. Yeah. And that's only reasonable. Before, when the U.S. government has bailed out corporations, right, it's like, okay, thank you for the bailout. But no, you can't have any control of the corporation. That would be socialism, right? Mm. You know, so they're actually talking about the U.S. government having some kind of equity stake in the corporations that it bails out. Well, what would that be the basis of? Well, something like an American sovereign wealth fund, basically. Something like what these oil sheikdoms have, or what Norway has, right? Mm-hmm. Where they take basically, they have a huge investment fund that they use to pay dividends out to the citizens. So mm-hmm. this could become the foundation for a shift towards universal basic income and a kind of social credit economy, which that sounds like paradise to me. so yeah, this is kind of remarkable. I think Andrew Anglin ran a parody headline. It was something like, "Trump delivers the socialist paradise we all deserve," or something like that. Trump promises the socialist paradise or communist paradise we all deserve. But yeah, that is part of the plan. So these are actually really, really good things. Another really good thing about it is that Trump's getting a little feisty about these politically correct shitheads who are more concerned about protecting the Chinese from bad words than they are from protecting their own neighbors from dying of a deadly disease. The people mm-hmm. who don't want to call this the Wuhan virus or the corona, or the Chinese virus or anything like that. They're more concerned about racism than they are about their own people. And that whole cult, the whole multi-cult, the idea that there's an absolute moral obligation to be open to everybody, right?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, absolute openness is meaningless if you're open to pandemics that are going to kill lots of people. Mm-hmm. At this point, xenophobia is not an absolute evil. There's a good kind of xenophobia now, the xenophobia that saves us from pandemics. That's the good kind of xenophobia. There's a good kind of racism, right? There's a reasonable kind of racism here. And I think that the charges of racism and xenophobia are just ceasing to be the moral kill shots that they were for a long time. And that's really a positive step forward, too.
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen in past decades, you know, in Scandinavia, for example, how diseases that went extinct in that part of the world basically 100 years ago, like tuberculosis and things like that, have started appearing again because of mass immigration. And this is just one more thing, because even with this thing exploding in China, they still continued to accept airplane after airplane full of people coming in from that part of the world, and they obviously didn't care about the consequences. And I really want to see when this is all, you know, when all said and done, when the case is closed on this thing, I want to see if someone is going to be held responsible for those decisions, because these people have caused the deaths will cause the deaths of many, many, many people and financial ruin for many others. And do they have no responsibility for that? I mean, when they just do things that any average or above average intelligent person would realize that, okay, there's a pandemic there, maybe we should stop people from traveling into our country from that country. If they just fail to do the most basic thing, that there should be some sort of legal consequences for that. Because, like I said, those decisions cost human lives and cause financial ruin for many, many people. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how the talk goes after all this, after we know the consequences.
Yeah, well, I just want to live through the whole thing because I want to be the relentless, nagging voice demanding these people be held accountable and saying, never forget, never mm-hmm. forget, never forgive the folly that led our civilization to this potential ruin. There was this phrase, the long 19th century. The 19th century lasted, in a way, sort of as a cultural thing, to the beginning of the First World War.
Right.
And I'm starting to think that the long 20th century is coming to an end in 2020 with the Wuhan virus, with the coronavirus, that we're going to see changes as dramatic as the changes that were wrought by the First World War.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting. We're living through history, and I pray that we all survive it and that we can make a better world after this. Because, again, capitalism, democracy, globalism, multiculturalism, all of these isms and ideologies have come together to create this terrible crisis for our civilization. And it would be really, really nice if people learn a lesson, a painful lesson from this, so that they don't listen to this nonsense again, and so that we can finally get sensible government back. We deserve better. We all deserve better than having ourselves delivered over to this chaos and plague because of the gross irresponsibility of the people who govern us.
You know, there's always this talk about the Second World War, the people who just went along with orders and killed Jews and participated in the Holocaust. And I think, was it Hannah Arendt who coined the term the banality of evil?
Yeah.
You know, just going along with orders. And I've always, you know, for years had this idea in my head that I should write an article called The Banality of Evil for, you know, the current administrators. Because the people, if you actually let airplanes full of people, hundreds of people fly in from an area hit by an epidemic, that is a level of banality of evil where you cause deaths and you just let it continue just because, well, you're just sort of following the zeitgeist. You're just following orders, man. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't take any responsibility for it.
Right.
Now, when are we going to see those Nuremberg trials, you know? When are we going to see those Simon Wiesenthal sort of persecution of these people after, you know, when they're 90 years old and, oh, this was a camp guard. You know, they chase him down somewhere in South America or something because he was following orders. Well, yeah, I want to see the same attitude toward, you know, these kinds of people just causing so much suffering and causing death and financial ruin. I think definitely we could talk about the banality of evil there, because at one point you just have to stop following those orders and actually, you know, do the right thing and turn this thing around. And I like what you said about the long 20th century, and I hope it's true, and I think it's true, because it is something like this, a wake-up call that is needed in order for people to turn around. And hopefully that this is it.
Yeah, hopefully it is. You know, your free market at work, America is awash, I think, at this point with coronavirus, and we are starting to see cases skyrocket. And my email inbox is flooded with offers from airlines offering cheap flights. And it's just appalling. We have airlines offering cheap flights to encourage people to get into enclosed petri dishes, basically, that fly through the air, so they can get sick and spread it all around, or spread it around if they're already sick. It's appalling. We should be basically shutting down domestic air travel in the United States, not allowing these companies to advertise cheap flights to get people to travel during a time of plague. It's total absurdity. But yeah, it's the banality of evil. It's just the chugging away of the capitalist system without any oversight from people who can harmonize it with the collective good of the society. And that's really the core of all of our problems. It's liberalism. And the way I define liberalism is not being open-minded or whatever, or tolerant. It's denying that there's any such thing as the common good of the of a society, and denying that the state has its proper role of pursuing the common good. Instead, you know, the individualist liberal view is that only individuals and their interests matter, and it's just wrong to prevent them from getting their kicks. And if airlines want to offer cheap rates so that plane loads of kids can fly to Florida for spring break during an epidemic, who are you to say no? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Who are you?
And even people who are supposedly on our side come with stupid shit like that. But what right do they have to deny private business owners to run? And that's such a, pardon my French, probably most of the listeners are Americans, but from a European perspective, that's a very American thing to say. In the sort of, land of the free, capitalist, that sense of the word, it just comes across as weird. Of course, if there's a pandemic, the state has to intervene.
Exactly. Instead, in America, you have people like Charlie Kirk wailing that March Madness has been canceled. there's just infantile, whining brats, self-indulgent whining brats, handing their money to cutthroat businessmen who are exposing them to all kinds of illnesses. It's an absurdity. Of course the state needs to get involved. And one of the things that's really being discredited here is the libertarian brain bug that basically is at the core of what we call conservatism in America, which is just classical liberalism, basically. That libertarian philosophy is poison. It's just a form of stupidity. Somebody asked me, what do you think about the stock market going down? And my response was, the market will come back. But all the people who die because of Republican greed and complacency, they'll be gone forever. And it's really just time to get serious. And America is not a serious country right now, but it's time to get serious.
Yeah. Yeah. And those people have to realize that the point of the economy is just a tool to serve the people. The people are not a tool to serve the economy or some economic principle or something like that.
Exactly.
And when we have to prevent a disaster, if that disaster is invasion level mass immigration, replacement level mass immigration, or if it is a pandemic to save millions of lives, then the economy will take the back seat.
Yeah.
The economy isn't the driver. The economy is just there to serve us. And we have to make exceptions or whatever when that's needed, because this is it's an exceptional situation.
Yeah. It's definitely an exceptional situation. Well, Frody, we've been going on for about an hour, and I think we've given people a lot of food for thought. I think the long 20th century is over, and we're entering a new era. And yeah, everybody, please, if you're out there listening to me, stay safe, take precautions, make sure that you and your loved ones live through this so that we can put our stamp on the world that's going to emerge at the end of this crisis.
Yeah, I'm going to be happily in isolation. I'm just going to go out for groceries, and I'm going to be here and I'm going to do some writing and some good work so that we can make the most of this situation. And I think we will. So very good.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.